It's WrestlePod, the Troopany Show, with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany. This is my show, and today I am joined by the glorious, the wonderful, the intelligent Mr. Alexander Watt of the BBC. How are you, sir?
Hello, the intelligent. That's setting me up for a fall. I was going to say, we're recording very, very early again, so we might sound stoned. I think that was what they said last time we recorded this early.
Yeah, we've had some timing issues, so we're actually recording on day of release. As soon as I record this, I'm taking it home, I'm editing it, and I'm posting it. So it's going to be an interesting morning. Talking about wrestling history, because today we are at the Tokyo Dome in 1991. As the crew at WrestleTalk TV's The Squash said, as normal, the Troopany Show is dealing with up-to-date matters. So my reply was, well, it's on the New Japan World, and that's where I watched it, so therefore, it is up-to-date. But you can find the show on New Japan World if you want to have a look at it, and there's some other places I'm sure you can find it as well. But we wanted to look at it from the point of view of 1991. As you know, we're kind of going through year by year the biggest cards at the moment through the 1990s. And this was a really, really big card. It was one of the first shows that really showed off the development of the talent swap deal between New Japan Pro Wrestling and World Championship Wrestling. World Championship Wrestling at the time was under the Hurd administration, which, as you may or may not know, was a joyous time for all involved. Not really. it was one of those shows that was actually really, really good. And it kind of set the tone for the wrestling business. I was thinking about this yesterday. And this show, and I think WrestleMania 6, which was around about the same time, really set the tone for what was going to happen in the 1990s. You had WWF on a downward slide. You had New Japan in the ascendancy. You had WCW kind of ticking over, but they were trying to get more international presence, and this was a real show of force for them as far as trying to develop these international deals. Alex, what are your thoughts on this show and where it sits in wrestling history?
I think it's really interesting, like you say, of it's sort of unique in like bringing two massive companies together at once and seeing those groups of talent interacting. Like it's just a really interesting example of where the business was at that time.
Yeah, it certainly is. And we're going to look at the show match by match as we normally do. So we'll start with the opening match, which was an 8-man tag. Animal Higuchi, Kengo Kimura, Asuma Kido, and Kantora Hoshino. I'll get these pronunciations right, which is not that easy to say in the morning. And they defeated the Outlaws, which was Super Strong Machine, Hiro Saito, Tatsuyoshi Goto, and Nori Hanaga in 10 minutes and 12 seconds. The Outlaws were kind of like the main heel group, as we see Bullet Club or Los Ignorables today. This faction business in New Japan Pro Wrestling has been around for a long time. And this was an entertaining 10 minutes, for sure. And Super Strong Machine, the last time we looked at him, he was a face in that tag team tournament that me, Marcus, and Chelsea looked at a couple of weeks ago. So obviously an awful lot had happened within that year. What did you reckon of this match, Alex?
Yeah, it's probably best described as what we know as nowadays when we talk about New Japan shows. It's like the get everyone else on the card kind of match, which they still do nowadays. It's funny as well. It's worth noting that the show on New Japan World is a lot longer and has, you know, all these kinds of matches as well. But they recorded it for the WCW pay-per-view and cut, sort of, this was cut. There are a few others that were cut from the broadcast itself for timing-wise, which, and also for, like, booking-wise, which we'll come on to later. This was just an interesting example of what Japanese wrestling was in 1991, like, with a bunch of guys who hit hard, I guess.
It was pretty basic, but it was well put together. I mean, I really enjoyed watching Super Strong Machine as a heel. That was interesting for a start, and he takes part later in the show as well. And it was interesting.
There's a few of those on the card where it's like this guy working heel, or, you know, seeing guys who are super young who'd then go on to do kind of great things in Japanese American wrestling as well. So it's quite funny watching it from that perspective.
Certainly it is. I mean, like, Animal Higuchi ended up being a massive trainer in Japan. He trained a lot of the Joshi stars that are around now. You know, he was one of the first guys not to be bothered about gender when it came to training. So it's interesting to see how much sway this particular match had on the rest of the wrestling business as well. And then we moved on to Shiro Koshinaka, Kaneyuki Kobayashi, Tayuki Ayazuka, and they defeated Tim Horner, Brian Pillman, and Tom Zenk in the first of the interpromotional matches. There's a lot of stuff going on in this match, as far as wrestling history is concerned. Let's just start with Tayuki Ayazuka, still active in New Japan Pro Wrestling. He's in Suzuki-gun. You know the crazy guy who beats up the commentators? This is him. He was still wrestling 27 years ago.
Sorry, that was me having a coughing fit. Sorry.
Yeah, this was him in his rookie year. And Ayazuka's done an awful lot in WCW. He was the guy that got beat up tagging with Tatsumi Fujinami less than a year later against the Steiner brothers. And he got bounced from pillar to post. Maybe that's why he's so angry now.
It probably is, yeah.
Of course, Brian Pillman is probably better known as the WWF Loose Cannon Brian Pillman, but here he was flying Brian Pillman still in his early days, and my personal preference of the Brian Pillman years, such a good worker, so cool to watch him wrestle. Tom Zink, massively underrated in WCW, and just massively underrated everywhere, and I always thought he would do more than he did in the wrestling business. Now, he had a run in WWF in the 1980s and was at WrestleMania 3, tagging with Rick Martel, and never really got anywhere other than upper mid-card status, which I thought was a shame because I thought he was really, really good. And Tim Horner, if recently Jim Cornette has gone on a massive rant about Tim Horner and his time in Smoky Mountain Wrestling, which is a very entertaining half hour, and you should listen to that as well.
Of course he has.
What did you reckon of this then, Alex? Because this is like... This was interesting because it was, no one was really heel or face. It was just kind of a bunch of guys wrestling.
Yeah. Well, that's the strange part about it. But there's a little bit of that vibe with some of the matches as well. One other, which we'll come on to in a bit, where it's like they're just hitting big moves, it seems like, a little bit, which is funny because that's sometimes the knock on... Japanese can be the knock on Japanese wrestling when it's not at its best, but this was still a really good piece of work. It was more like you say, watching it from like the historical aspect, seeing like Brian Pillman as Flying Brian and that young, like this was like I think a year before he was doing all the stuff with Jushin Thunder Liger and WCW and, you know, really making a name for himself that way. And yeah, like you say, seeing Ayazuka that young, it's just crazy seeing how young, you know, some of those guys at this age, like in rookie years, like we'll talk about Chono in a second, which is also strange seeing him like how young he looks. Yeah, this is an interesting one as well. Cause I think you probably watched the full version on New Japan World. I think I watched the clip version that they did for WCW TV. And it shows a little bit that they've clipped it down because it's a little bit clunky the way they've edited it. So it makes it even more so like, here's a big move and now I'll hit a big move, you know. And there are a couple of examples of that throughout the show where WCW had tried to clip the matches to make them fit TV, and it were made for a bit of a weird viewing experience.
Yeah, because Tim Horner got an awful lot of time in this match, which was incredible. It was really unusual because he was just above jobber status in WCW, to be fair. And he was really good in this match. He was a strong wrestler, and you know, he got a lot of time in, which is unusual for him. So I think he was enjoying himself a lot more, to be honest. also, Shiro Koshinaka, the master of the butt. All those hip attacks you see from Taguchi in New Japan and Asuka in WWE, or NXT, I should say, and Akira Shida in various Joshi promotions, he's the one that really made hip attacks famous. Or as you quite succinctly put it, arse attack.
Yeah. It's basically we have him to blame for Taguchi's constant ass attacks.
that's the... that's, you know, this is it's interesting to find out where all this stuff comes from. And you know, these Koshinaka ended up being a big name player in New Japan. He'd just come off a stint in All Japan, and obviously that derailed him, because if you switch promotions in this time period, there was no chance you were getting to main event, no matter how good you were. But he did have a run at the IWGP Championship a couple of years later. So, you know, he was a main event player, kind of slumming it a little bit down here in the mid card, but he had some awful good guys to slum it with.
He certainly did.
And then we move on to perhaps the worst professional wrestling match I've ever seen in my life. Scott Norton. I like Scott Norton. There are some people who don't like Scott Norton. Hi, Ben Spindler. How are you doing? And he wrestled the Equalizer, who you may know as Evad Sullivan from his WCW days. A man described by Mick Foley in his book as a really nice guy, just before everyone described him as what a terrible worker he was. and I have no... When he croaked up in New Japan Pro Wrestling, which I was kind of getting from time to time at the time by Eurosport, I was like, what the hell's going on with this? He is dreadful. He is atrocious. there is no other way to describe it. And we'll talk about what happens at the end of the match in a moment. But Alex, your thoughts?
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good at all. And yeah, I mean, Scott Norton's like a legend over in Japan, and this was not the best use of him. Let's put it that way. Yeah, the Equalizer. I've never really seen this before. Obviously, I've read about him in, like you say, Mick Foley's book and stuff, but I'd never witnessed it firsthand. And it just, it's like they've tried to recreate Bruiser Brody, but with someone without any talent whatsoever.
Yeah, and it's talent,
yeah, the whole match was just two guys elbowing and stomping each other, basically.
And at the end of the match, Scott lands a big clothesline, pins him, gets the three, but lifts on three because he wants to finish it his way. And I'm wondering how much of that was, I want to make sure he knows that he's rubbish.
Yeah.
Because he picks him up, then hurls him into the ropes for a power slam, which was Scott Norton's finisher. But grabs him, but he comes off the rope so awkwardly that Scott grabs him by the tights, yanks really hard, and exposes the Equalizer's testicles to 64,000 people in attendance and the fans at home who are watching on pay-per-view, which was like, ah! We don't need to see
that.
Yeah,
as if the match wasn't, you know, bad enough, then you get indecent exposure as well thrown into the mix.
A 2 minute and 23 second match that was 2 minutes and 20 seconds too long.
2 minutes and 23 seconds too long, what am I saying?
But yes, so that, but again, you know, for some reason, the Equalizer then gets a job with WCW after this and gets a main event push, proving that in WCW you can fail upwards.
It's just such a perfect example of the failings of WCW. Like, they did a lot right in the early 90s, but they did also stuff like this as well.
Then we move on to match four, which was the true opening match for the WCW card, which is Jushin Thunder Liger, who was defending his IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship against Akira Nogami. 16 minutes and 8 seconds. This was exceptionally good. This was really, really good. I loved this. It was interesting to see Liger in a green outfit. That was one he doesn't get out very often anymore.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was good technical wrestling. It really showed how much of a flyer Liger was at this particular time period and what his wrestling style was like, and really showed off what the New Japan Junior Heavyweights could do. What did you think, Alex?
Yeah, well, I agree on the green outfit. That was yeah, I've not really seen him wrestling that before. And yeah, Nogami I didn't know a huge amount about, but was, you know, a really good worker. It was obviously more about seeing Jushin Liger, like you say, at that age when he was one of the best workers in the world, like the best junior heavyweight in the world, doing this innovative stuff that basically, you know, he pioneered this style, as we've spoken about on podcasts before, and finished it with a top rope DDT, which is just brutal, especially for 1991, when you see him do that.
Yeah.
That is such a crazy finisher.
Yeah, I mean, Senor Laureato, I think it was doing some gifts of Owen Hart versus Jushin Liger from the year before.
Yes, I saw the very same post.
And just watching that DDT in isolation as a gif, you realize how brutal it was, because he buries Owen's head in the mat. It was like, it was ridiculous. And now Owen, the master seller, obviously is going to take it incredibly well, but it was just like, oh my God.
Yeah. And it is, it's just like, this is the early 90s. Like, this is when, you know, Ric Flair's still headlining shows, and you've got Jushin Liger doing moves like that over in Japan. It's crazy.
It was slightly bizarre. And also, but I mean, this kind of plays into what I was saying about, This card sets the tone for Japan in the 1990s. This was an exceptionally good quality card, apart from the previous match. But, you know, even greater cards have terrible matches on. And it was kind of like a touchstone for what the rest of wrestling was going to be like, and a passing of the guard. And the next match kind of like highlights that. You've got Arn Anderson and Barry Windham just fresh off their Horseman run. They were technically not the Horsemen anymore, but they were tagged.
Yeah, that was really strange that they then tagged them back together. There are a couple of examples of this on the show, I think, where it was like, they aren't a team anymore, but we'll put them as a team just for the sake of this show.
They were doing no end of TV matches. There was all sorts of six-mans with Flair, Windham and Anderson together. That period, you can go back and watch their TV tapings. And they're not the Horsemen, but they're still good friends. Which is really
they
weird.
They still hang out and drink together, those guys, you know.
And they drank a lot.
Yes, yes, they did.
These days, apparently, Barry Windham is a major player in the Lincolnshire Conservative Party, according to Wikipedia.
Really?
I've never come across him, and I've been in Lincolnshire politics for many years, but Lincolnshire is a big place geographically, so I've never come across him. So one day I'm hoping, if I can talk to some of my Conservative friends, I haven't got many of them, I'll see if I can get to meet Barry Windham. But they were
that is so out of left field.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, it's like, I was like reading the Wikipedia, and then you read like the WCW, NWA, WWF run, and then he goes to the end. And now lives in Lincolnshire and is a member of the local Conservative Party. Like, what? Anyway.
Imagine going to that council meeting.
He comes in with that ZZ Top Light theme tune as he walks in the room.
Does he still have the bleach blonde hair as well?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I'd have to see. Anyway, they were
and the porno tash as well.
that was weird. I don't know what that was about. that tash would make a comeback in the return of the new Blackjacks in the WWF in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
They were wrestling Master Saito, a man we've talked about a lot on this podcast, and Masahiro Chono in 9 minutes, and the match went 9 minutes 17. With the former Horseman winning. This was entertaining, but it was a solid old school style wrestling match, and much more what you expect from New Japan, hard hitting, head down wrestling. Interestingly, Arn and Barry started off with a handshake, but it kind of broke down after that.
Yeah.
The goodwill evaporated fairly quickly afterwards. And I forgot how good Barry Windham was. You know, Barry Windham in this period was one of the best workers in the world, and it just amazes me that he never went further than he did. I know Flair was his kind of like, Flair wanted him as champion when he left WCW about a year later, and it was like, he really should have had a good long extended run with that championship, I think.
Yeah, it was politics, I think, that stopped him from doing that, sadly.
As always, he got Lex Luger'd.
But was a hell of a lot more entertaining than Lex Luger, obviously.
Yes, sorry Lex, but it's true, and I think Lex would probably agree with that now. What did you think of this match, anyway?
Yes, yeah, like you say, it was very, very old school, particularly, you know, you've got Arn in there, who was kind of slowing it down to that old school wrestling pace. It was, the interesting part was Arn doing those kind of old school tricks, and it felt kind of strange in this environment to see that, because it's obviously a Japanese show. So to see kind of the old school NWA style in that kind of environment was quite an interesting viewing experience. Also, Masahiro Chono, who looked about five in this match, like he looked so young, it's crazy. And I mean, is this? I'm trying to sort of figure out date wise. When's all his big G1 wins? Is that sort of 93 kind of
yeah,
time?
Yeah, he starts to run in the mid 90s. He was about, the Three Musketeers had reformed at this point, and he was about a year into his run back in New Japan after his excursions. He'd been to Texas and a lot of the southern United States as well. So, yeah, he'd done a lot of work outside of Japan, and the fans were just starting to get behind him as a homegrown talent. So he was on the up, certainly, at this particular time period, but he wasn't yet at his peak. So, yeah, this was really, really good as well. I mean, it's also interesting because it was kind of like NWA-style wrestling, but with New Japan booking, so it was a lot more back and forth rather than one team being dominant and then the others hot-tagging in.
Yeah, I think that's it's like a good example of what this show was meant to be, because that it's those two things coming together, and seeing like you say, Barry Windham interacting with Chono and Arn Anderson and Slato just beating the crap out of one another. It's a really sort of microcosm of the two companies thrown into one.
Yeah. And the next match kind of echoes that, really. I mean, it's the NWA kind of classic team of the Steiner brothers, right at their very peak as one of the best tag teams in the world, if not the best tag team in the
probably
world.
Probably the, yeah, I think at this time they probably were the best tag team in the world.
And they're wrestling Hiroshi Hase and Kintsuki Sasaki. Now, Sasaki and Hase were the IWGP tag team champions. The Steiner brothers were the WCW tag team champions. This was a belt-for-belt match. It went 12 minutes and 56 seconds. Now, when this match happened at the time, it was widely considered to be the greatest tag match ever at that particular point. And this was a couple of years before Minami Toyota and Toyota and Yamada would take on Iyazaki and Dynamite Kansai and All Japan Women and take that unofficial title, the greatest match tag team match ever. And it was exceptionally good, but I kind of bought into the Kool-Aid of it a little bit, because you've got like Lance Russell on commentary on WCW TV shows saying this is the greatest tag match I've ever seen. If Lance Russell says it's the greatest tag match you've ever seen, it's the greatest tag match he's ever seen, you know. And looking at it now, it probably isn't quite as good as it is as people made it out to be at the time, 20 years removed, but it was exceptional for the time period, looking at it in that particular sense. I kind of consider it as one of these mythical matches I never got to see at the time. And when I look back at it, I still have a fond nostalgia for it, but maybe is slightly disappointing. I'm not sure. What do you think of it, Alex?
Fully where I was going to go with it. Like, I think it won Match of the Year in the Wrestling Observer newsletter, and like you say, it was bigged up as this incredible example of tag team wrestling. It's really good still. It hasn't necessarily aged as well as you might have hoped. I was probably expecting a little bit more, like when you, particularly with where tag team wrestling would end up going, like you say, you've cited that match. Oh, off the top of my head, I'm trying, Kobashi and Misawa,
yeah,
Tao, and you know the one I mean.
Yeah, Tao and Saruta.
Yeah, from like 90, 94, 95, which is absolutely insane. And then, you know, once you're starting to get into the noughties and the stuff that's, you know, it's unfair to compare it then to the stuff that's happening today. But you get the point I'm making, like where tag team wrestling ended up going, particularly with the problem watching a match like this now is we've gotten used to these crazy closing stretches in tag matches that this can't necessarily like live up to that, but it was still really good. Seeing, you know, the Steiner brothers at that time, like suplex and everything in sight. and it was very much like, there was a lot of head dropping. You know, it was that kind of, big move, dropping each other on their heads, kind of strong style Japanese meeting American strong style, and it was really good for the time. Also seeing Sasaki again looking really young, which is crazy. So I would agree with you that it's kind of got this mythical status that it's not, you know, on that level, but it's still a really cool piece of work. Also, what the Steiner Brothers music, it really sounds like, this is such a random observation, but this is what you expect from me, I'm sure. it sounds like, do you remember that Superman song from kids' parties in the 90s? Yeah. It really, really sounds like that. Like, clap your hands, brush your hair.
Well, see, because I watched it on New Japan World, and I watched it match by match rather than watching the whole thing, and they didn't have the introductions. They started from in the ring. So I'm not sure.
Well, they did. It was at the end of the match when they won, because I had the same thing where it just started in the ring, so I didn't watch the walk out, and then that music just came on while they were celebrating. It was like, that sounds weirdly familiar.
Well, you see, it's a bit strange, because the Steiner Brothers in WCW at the time were coming out to Welcome to the Jungle, because WCW didn't either paid for the money for the music, or we just weren't bothered.
Yeah.
And, so it was interesting to see how they were presented differently in different promotions. And we should spend some time on Sasaki and Hase as well, because it's not like they were along for the ride. And generally speaking, we speak of the Steiners as these great amateurs who turned into professionals, but Hase was probably a more qualified amateur than they were. He was an Olympic standard wrestler who made the Japanese Olympic team in the early 80s. So, you know, it was really like for like. And Sasaki was, he was kind of like the prototype of a similar kind of thing. You know, the Steiners were science and power, that was their thing. They were great wrestlers, but they had all that bulk and muscle mass as well. They were kind of like an intelligent road warriors, if you see what I mean. And Hase and Sasaki were very much the same thing. And it was kind of a point of where tag team wrestling was at the time. I mean, if you look at the 80s, it was really dominated by the technically great teams like the Hart Foundations, the Bulldogs, the Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express. And then you have this period where the Road Warriors come along and every team is 6'6" and 300 pounds and looks like a brick outhouse. And then you get this period in the 1990s where you've got science mixed with power. And it's kind of gone back down to either power or science again, really, in tag team wrestling. I suppose you get the Revival or kind of a mix of that. They're kind of as close to you as what you're going to get. Alpha, American Alpha as well. So, yeah, it was just an interesting kind of like match to talk about because it was so important historically. So.
And that's why it was probably so revered at the time and still, you know, is an entertaining watch, is because they match up really well because they are quite similar, the two teams.
Yeah. Okay, then going from the sublime to the ridiculous, and a match that wasn't as awful as Scott Norton and the Equalizer, but El Gigante versus Big Cat Hughes, two men known for their immobility.
It's worrying that you can say, like, this wasn't as bad as the Equalizer versus Scott Norton and be completely right, because, like, the fact that these two had a better match than something else on the card is mental.
Well, I mean, it's like, this match's story was get El Gigante over as this giant, and that's what they did. You could argue this is a 5-star match because it did the job it was supposed to do.
Yeah.
It'd be a stretch, don't get me wrong, and Dave Meltzer would probably shout at me for this, but it did what
the star rating system isn't perfect.
No,
so,
but
it
did exactly what it's supposed to do. Gigante went over in 2 minutes and 16 seconds, as you'd expect, and Big Cat Hughes, for once, actually bumped for somebody. So yeah, it was all right. Did what it said on tin. Wouldn't write out about it or anything. What did you reckon?
No. Well, yeah, pretty much that. It was pretty much just a squash to get Gigante over. But the bloody claw is still no better. Like, you know, watching it nowadays, the fact that they tried to recreate this with the Great Khali in the noughties just pains me a little bit. but yeah, like you say, it achieved what they wanted to achieve, which is makes it a lot better than the Scott Norton Equalizer belt, which was just dreadful. Like, at least you can point to this and say, you know, they wanted to get this guy over and they did, and the crowd seemed to to like it for what it was. So I think they liked seeing this big, massive guy. So because it's that kind of, for lack of a better term, the freak show element that Japan still really likes to this day. Is they love great wrestling, but they also like big, weird guys.
And then the next match after that was where we get into the booking issues, which were Big Van Vader and Bam Bam Bigelow defeated Doom, Ron Simmons and Butch Reed. Ron Simmons and Butch Reed were a great tag team in WCW. I loved them as the Monster Heels Doom, and they were the perfect foil for the Steiner brothers in so many ways. But the interesting thing about this match was they'd broken up 2 months before. But thanks to the vagaries of WCW television, they were still together. So at the end of this match, which was a really, really epic back-and-forth battle, Butch and Ron had a falling out to match up with TV storylines in WCW, which was a bit ridiculous.
Well, was it not something like they'd broken up in WCW, but they'd signed this deal for the New Japan show, so that's why they had to work together in the match or something like that?
Yeah, it was. They actually mentioned that in Pro Wrestling Illustrated on the review of their match, because they actually cover this in PWI really extensively, because it was a big news show for them, which was not something PWI did at the time. They didn't really cover Japan very much. They do a lot more now, but they certainly didn't cover it then. And they pointed out it was a contractually obligated match. Now, PWI always talk in kayfabe and storylines, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was something New Japan really wanted, because Doom were a great team, and it would make a great match. And it did. It was, as far as power brawling is concerned, it doesn't really get much better than this. It was really, really cool to watch, especially when you've got guys like Vader and Bigelow who are huge, but they can actually wrestle and make a match work really well.
Two of the best big guy workers ever.
Yeah, and what did you think of it as a general matchup?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. Like you say, the booking issues sort of overshadow it a little bit, because WCW never actually aired the match on on their version of the show, because I guess they were just like we say, with the it was contractually obligated that Doom do the match, and then it seemed like they were just like, well, we're not going to be able to explain this, so we'll just not air the match ourselves, which is a shame, because it was probably one of the best things on the show as an overall package. Like, it was a really fun match, so the fact that they had to cut it from the broadcast was probably a little bit irritating for them.
And also, standard WCW procedure: we can't explain it, therefore it didn't happen.
Yeah, and it sort of just sums up that, like we say, there's a lot of good stuff that WCW did, but this is like such a great example of like the ridiculous side of things, like not planning ahead and just, I mean, I don't know what the plan was like in terms of, breaking up the team. It wouldn't shock me if it was just like, they almost forgot that they had this booked, like knowing what WCW bookers could be like at the time.
Yeah, because they didn't really exploit Ron Simmons versus Butch Greed greatly either, and Teddy Long was just kind of like out of a job for a while. He was off TV because he was their manager on TV, and then he suddenly just disappeared. He had nothing to do. I think he ended up managing Dan Spivey and the Angel of Death as a kind of Skyscrapers reunion kind of team, but that was about it. And then everything kind of, the next time we saw Teddy Long, he was a face and managing Ice Train. Which as downfalls go, was pretty steep.
Yeah, that's a fall from grace.
Because obviously he is obsessed with tag teams, and it genuinely is. All through his career, he's just been obsessed with tag teams. It wasn't just a Monday Night Managers thing, it was just that.
I was going to say, yeah, when he became general manager, and still obsessed with tag matches all the time.
And the daft thing was, on the other side of the ring, you had Big Van Vader and Bam Bam Bigelow, who were being booked as a great tag team at the time. They're working face to the most natural heels in pro wrestling history. And also, they genuinely didn't like one another. They basically...
I think I have heard bits of this, but...
Yeah, and there was just, as professionals, they got on with each other to get through the matches, but they just genuinely didn't like each other's personalities. There was no, like, fights over it or anything. Because, like, Finn Martin interviewed Bam Bam Bigelow around this time in WCW, and Bam Bam said, the thing is, me and Leon don't get on, but it's a job, so we do it.
Yeah, just rubbed each other up the wrong way, kind of thing. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, so that was an interesting match from politics on all sides.
But just quickly on the heel face thing, there were a few examples of that throughout the show. I noticed, like, guys seemed like they were working the opposite to probably what they should be working, kind of thing.
Yeah, because I think, go on.
Yeah, no, go on.
I was going to say,
it's just interesting.
Zink, yeah. Pillman and Horner weren't really working face, they were just kind of working, weren't they? They weren't really going one way or the other.
Mm.
Yeah, so it was interesting. But yeah, and then after that was another match that didn't make it to the WCW broadcast either, which was Ricky Chosu versus Tiger Jeet Singh.
Speaking of some of the worst wrestlers in history, Tiger Jeet Singh was not a talented man.
Yeah, this was for the Greatest 18 MMA title. So let's start with that. The Greatest 18 MMA title was previously known as the WWF Mixed Martial Arts title. Prior to that, that was unified with the NWF World Championship, which was independent from upstate New York, where Antonio Inoki took the title in the early 1970s and kept it when the NWF went out of business. And he became the NWF champion, which was the major title defended in the 1970s as their home championship in New Japan. Vince McMahon Sr. bestowed the MMA title upon Antonio Inoki. He merged it with the NWF title, which is why in the commentary they start mentioning Johnny Valentine and all these people who held the NWF title before Antonio Inoki. And then obviously when they left the WWF, they couldn't call it the WWF MMA title anymore, so they called it the Greatest 18 Club MMA Championship. And it wasn't around for much longer after this, because it was actually merged with the IWGP Championship when Ricky Chosu challenged for the IWGP title a couple of months down the line. So this was a match that was slightly pointless in the end. But the actual match, as far as like entertainment value is concerned, is purely more than entertaining for anything else, for the level of swearing I have ever heard in any match. And it all comes from Ricky Chosu. Now, there was a match last year involving Honma and Makabe versus Gorillas of Destiny, which we thought there was more swearing.
I was just going to reference that.
Yeah, but this actually probably gives it a run for its money, but it's just from one guy. What did you think of this, Alex?
I mean, in fairness, the that tag match was just from Tangaroa as well. so yeah, it'd be interesting to do the swear count on it to see which actually had more. This happened. Tiger Jeet Singh was just, I don't think he ever had a decent match, did he?
Was another selfish performance that was all about him and nobody else.
Yeah, basically like doing sort of a poor man's chic routine that just never really worked. And I guess it was just a shame that this is the match that Ricky Chosu was in for the show, considering what we know he can do. It would have been nice to see him do something else, but there you go.
Yeah.
Not really a surprise that this one didn't make the main WCW broadcast, not protest. I would like to protest this match.
Well, there's a couple of reasons why it didn't make the WCW show. One, it wasn't really a wrestling match. It was done under last man standing rules, essentially. So it was a count out win, nothing else. Secondly, there was blood everywhere. Both of them bled like stuck pigs through the entire match. Ricky Chosu bladed early, and Tiger Jeet Singh bladed not long after. And you actually watch the main event, and there's just blood all over the mat from both of them. Mm. So that would not fly on a WCW broadcast pay-per-view or not. And then there's the swearing. and it's dreadful.
Yeah.
So
I mean, the finish was interesting, at least we can say, maybe.
Explain the finish then. It's probably the best way to go.
Exposed turnbuckle, and Chosu lariated him into the turnbuckle to knock him out, which was at least a creative way of ending the match, which, because not much else in this match was creative, so give them some credit for that one.
Yeah, and it kind of protected Jeet Singh, which was what he was always after, I guess.
Yeah, oh God.
Yeah. 11 minutes and 7 seconds, if you want to watch it, purely from a historical point of view. I wouldn't watch it from an wrestling entertainment point of view, certainly. It wasn't a great brawl, but it's well worth it just for listening to Riki Choshu swearing so much. Because he's very stoic normally in wrestling matches. He doesn't really say an awful lot. And in this one, yeah. I think he was genuinely angry as well. That didn't help.
Yeah, I don't think he was enjoying working with his opponent, let's put it that way. But yeah, it's interesting once you start talking about the show. It's like there's a lot of good, really good, like historically exciting stuff, and that. But there's also like a lot of duds on the card as well, which is quite an interesting snapshot of where the business was at the time, I suppose.
Yeah, good and terrible. Is really,
yeah. There's not much in between, is there?
No, there isn't really. No. The next match was good, though. In fact, thankfully, the last two matches were pretty great. The next match was Sting versus the Great Muta, and this was a dream match. It had been requested by New Japan fans for years. They'd had the feud in WCW in 1989 over the World Television title, which Muta had come out on top from. And in this match, Muta was on top form again, and he defeated Sting in 11 minutes and 41 seconds. Now, the interesting thing is, the Great Muta is not Kieji Muto. They are two different people. Though they have the same moves, and they as Matt Hardy would say, they have the same vessel. They are two different people. They are not the same wrestler. And the Muta does different things to what Kieji Muto would do. One of which is just being much more heelish generally, even though he was massively popular. And this was Muta at its full-on Muta. You know, he starts the match off, kicks Sting in the gut, goes for the power drive, backflip elbow, and then goes for the moonsault straight away, and he misses, but it kind of sets the tone for the match. This is going to be a roller coaster ride.
Yeah, it was really good. Like, I was shocked at how quickly it started off, you know, from both sides. You know, Muta rushed him at the bell and, like you say, hit the handspring elbow in the corner, went for the moonsault, and then he dived over the top rope to hit Sting, and then a minute later, Sting dived over the top rope to hit him, and it was like, God, this is quite a pace for the time. It was a really good match, I thought.
Yeah, because I mean, Sting was we kind of see Sting as baseball bat and crow kind of Sting, and this was the old Sting at his best, you know.
Yeah.
He'd had a year since he'd had the big knee injury. And dropped the title to Flair 3 months before at Starrcade, at the original Starrcade in the States. So he was kind of like, he was fully fit, he was fully functioning, and he was really going for it. And interestingly, seconding him was Tim Horner, Brian Pillman, and the Steiner brothers as well, whilst the Muta's crew were all of the New Japan guys at the top of the card. So it was interesting to see that as well, how they'd adapted the Japanese kind of like, you need a second to make a match work. And yeah, it was really, really good. Really good presentation and really good match just generally.
Yeah, kept them both strong. Obviously, the way they did the finish with Muta essentially cheating to win and then Sting attacking him after the bell to stay looking strong. It was interesting as well that Muta worked it as heel, Sting worked it as babyface, essentially.
Yeah.
For obviously not that weird if they were doing it in America, but it was quite weird for them to go that way when they were working in New Japan.
Yeah.
Especially since Sting came out looking like he was on his way to a Donald Trump rally. He was wearing so much stars and stripes.
Yeah, it was really interesting how the presentation worked in this. It was just a cool match to watch, and this had its mythical kind of characterization towards it as well. Maybe not as much as the Steiners and Hase and Sasaki, but certainly this was better than what they'd done for the TV title because they were both that bit older, but they were still within the prime of their lives. So the match was going to be better just because they knew that bit more.
I felt like this. Maybe this is controversial. I don't know. I felt like this held up better than the Steiners match did. I don't know what your take on that is.
I think
just
so.
Because of that, yeah, that opening sequence was so fast paced.
Yeah, I think also because it's not talked about as much, people haven't gone on and on about it, so you kind of come to it with a fresh set of eyes, whereas you kind of have a higher expectation of what that tag match was going to do.
Yeah, I think that is a big part of it. Plus, it's like, you know, it's two really famous characters as well as being two great wrestlers. You know, you come for like the personas as well, which were both really hot at the time.
Yeah. And then we moved on to the main event, which was a political nightmare of epic proportions.
Oh, the background to this one.
Yes. So let's start there. We have the Nature Boy, Ric Flair, defending the WCW and NWA World Heavyweight Championships against the Dragon, Tatsumi Fujinami, who's defending the IWGP Heavyweight Championship. Now, with the Dragon defending the IWGP Heavyweight Championship, that's all fine and dandy. But the WCW title was also the NWA world title. It was the WCW was still kind of the part of the NWA, and no one had ever got out of the NWA because it was another one of those things WCW forgot about. So the result at the end of this match was quite spectacular as to what happened in wrestling politics. We'll talk about that in a second. But this match was way different. It was presented in a much more traditional Japanese manner. You had the girls before the match. Of course, Flair came to the ring with girls in swimsuits, all blonde and American. and Fujinami came to the ring in his dead serious pose. And you had two referees as well. You had Tiger Hattori, who was representing New Japan and refereeing in the New Japan way. He was the referee on the outside of the ring to ensure that there was no cheating going on. And you had Bill Alfonso, Daddy. He was the referee for WCW, because people forget that Bill Alfonso was a WCW referee before he was an ECW referee and manager, and had a stint in the WWF at the same time, and historically was a Florida referee too. So he was incredibly experienced. Actually, probably the biggest crowd he ever worked in front of, but also the least remembered because of his work in ECW as a manager later on. So that kind of set the stage up. And then you kind of have a standard Flair match and a standard Fujinami match all wrapped into one, which is never a bad thing.
Yeah,
so it was really cool. What did you reckon of this match then, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a good way to describe it. It was those two guys working to their strengths, I suppose. It was especially interesting to see all Flair's signature spots and tricks in this kind of environment. Not sure they all worked, but it made for an interesting spectacle, and it was a really good match and a really interesting example of those two styles coming together between two of, you know, the most important wrestlers in the world at the time. The fact that it took 15 minutes for Ric Flair to start bleeding was quite strange.
Oh, yeah, he did a blade job. But again, like it was said, it's a standard big Flair match, so therefore he has to do a blade job at some point.
Exactly, yeah. Well, he has to do the blade job, then get hit, walk out of the corner and flop on his face, which he did. And to be fair, the crowd popped big for it as well.
Yeah.
So it worked. But yeah, once they really started going down the closing stretch, it was really, really good. When they were going back and forth and just, you know, trading chops and big strikes, which is kind of what people came to see, I suppose. And then that led into the finish, which we'll go into further. But for the main part of the match was really good, I thought.
Yeah, it was. We did get a Flair flip and we did get a Flair flop. It was value for money on its Flairness. And also what I really noticed as well was Flair selling for Fujinami. Fujinami goes for the Dragon Sleeper early and Flair really sells it. He'd clearly been watching tapes to see how to get the best out of Fujinami, and likewise Fujinami tried to get the best out of Flair. Fujinami never looked less than dominant, though, even though Flair was on the offense and had good stretches of offense, but Fujinami looked sure of himself and it looked like he was going to be dominant through the match. And then we get to the finish, which was kind of a spin on the dusty finish of epic proportions. So let's explain. In the match, they're working around the ropes, and Bill Alfonso gets accidentally hit by Flair and is knocked out underneath the top rope. Whilst that's going on, Fujinami gets a bunch of printing predicaments, and the crowd count three, but there's no referee because Tiger Hattori is looking after Bill Alfonso outside the ring. Eventually, Hattori gets to his feet, gets inside the ring when Alfonso's cleared his head. But just before that, Fujinami backdrops Flair over the top rope. So they get back inside the ring. Fujinami manages to hit a rolling cradle and pins Flair for the championship and wins the WCW and NWA World's Heavyweight Championship and holds the IWGP Heavyweight Championship and is carried shoulder high by the IWGP roster. New Japan roster. Now, after this match, there was numerous decisions. First of all, WCW refused to recognize the title change because Bill Alfonso saw that Fujinami backdrop Flair over the top rope, which in WCW is a disqualification. Sorry, was a disqualification. Obviously, the IWGP title did not change hands. But the NWA ruling of the time was that the home promotion's rules stand. So therefore, Fujinami did beat Flair for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. So for a while, Fujinami was recognized as the NWA World Champion and the IWGP World Champion, but WCW only recognized Flair as the World Champion. They went to Super Brawl 2, I think it was, in a couple of months' time, and tidied that up with a Flair win over Fujinami, which I actually think was probably a better match, but not as emotional, because the fans at Super Brawl didn't really know who Fujinami was, which was unfortunate.
Yeah, that was on WCW for not explaining it well enough, really.
But when you have complicated finishes like this...
Yeah, exactly. But then they just sort of brought in Fujinami and never really explained the situation or why, you know, who this guy was, why he was so important, etc., etc.
Yeah, so it was a bit of a mess, to say the least.
Was it, from my understanding, was this to do with that they needed Fujinami to win in Japan, so they had to think of a way to do it, but obviously they couldn't have Flair lose the title because he was their top guy in America.
Yeah, that was it. And I mean, it was like, and it's also as well, it's noticeable when you listen to the commentary, they don't talk about the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. They talk about the NWA World Heavyweight Championship because the NWA World Heavyweight Championship has much more cachet in Japan because of all those matches with Ricky Dozan and Lou Thesz and Harley Race dropping the title to Baba. And New Japan was a member at the NWA at this time. You know, All Japan had let their NWA membership lapse. It was no longer of any use to them. So New Japan picked it up. And it's something Antonio Inoki had wanted since the early 1970s. But because Baba was so tight with the other NWA promoters, and there was only one NWA promotion in every territory, he never got the opportunity to. So the moment the opportunity arised, he grabbed it with both hands. So this was an excellent way of getting Fujinami over as the NWA World Heavyweight Champion as well as the New Japan, as well as the IWGP Heavyweight Championship. Whether the NWA had any input into this title change or not, from a booking point of view, I doubt they did. But it certainly kick-started the NWA into doing something about this. Because a year later, there is new people on the NWA board. They start petitioning for shots at the world champion, who was Ron Simmons at the time, and eventually WCW work out a deal where they revive the NWA World Championship as a separate entity and the NWA World Tag Team Championships, even though there have been no official NWA World Tag Team Championships before. All those title matches in the Carolinas for the NWA World Tag Team Championships, they were unofficial. You know, this was the first time there was an NWA Tag Team Championship that was officially sanctioned by the NWA. So it became a really important thing for WCW in the next 2 years, and involving the NWA more greatly in their product, and certainly was for New Japan. And you can say how much respect New Japan has for the NWA titles, even to this day, though they aren't working on a talent swap agreement with NWA anymore. They certainly pushed those NWA championships when they were working with them.
And yeah, like you say, it's the lineage and the history and the prestige and all that kind of stuff, because that's obviously something Japan takes very seriously, especially with the IWGP Championship. just before we move on, I would say, like, as you know, it's quite interesting, all the politics around it and stuff like that, and as muddled as it all was, I actually thought the finish, for what it was actually really well done. Like, it could have been a lot messier, but as they did it, it was actually quite smartly done, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah, I think as well, you couldn't have done it with two other referees. Tiger Atori was experienced enough to understand what was trying to go on, and Bill Alfonso had all that experience from Florida where things like this happened all the time.
Yeah.
So to him, it was just another day at the office. Oh, I'm taking a bump, am I? Right, okay.
But it's like, you know, around that time, like you say, you've referenced like the dusty finish and stuff like that. Sometimes these finishes would just be nonsensical and they'd be really muddled and badly done. And like, so it was... You know, I knew the story behind the match, and I've read, you know, a lot about it anyway, but I hadn't actually seen the match until watching it to record this. So I was quite surprised, actually, that in practice it actually worked really well.
Yeah, I think as well it works for that audience because they won't have seen anything like it before. At this point, you tend to get clean finishes, and that changes as you get into the UWF, where after the UWF, everything becomes a clean finish. But this is the start point of that. So because this audience has been used to clean finishes, they buy into it as a clean finish, which is exactly what you want for a dusty finish. You want the audience to buy into it as a clean finish. Here's your new champion. And then, you know, if you do it every once in a while, sparingly, you know, and again, this was, as Jim Cornette said recently, because I was listening to his comments on the dusty finish. He said it isn't the dusty finish; it's the Eddie Graham finish. That's where Dusty got it from.
Yeah,
this is a Florida finish, hence why Bill Alfonso is the perfect guy to do it with. You know, so it's a Florida finish, not a Dusty Rhodes finish technically, but Eddie Graham was smart enough to do it once every 5 years instead of once a fortnight.
Yeah, and that's worth like saying as well, particularly in Japan, this was so rare, whereas people who watch New Japan nowadays will probably notice that it gets used a lot more because of clubs like, you know, the Bullet Club, like LIJ, and we've spoken about modern New Japan maybe relying on this stuff a bit too often, but back then this like never happened.
Yeah.
This sort of stuff.
Yeah, you know, even then, I mean me and T'other Alex talked last week about the finish in the All Japan Real World Tag League and the bell going slightly early on the count of three instead of after the count of three. And it's just something that never, ever happened. It's so noticeable because everyone was so professional, everyone's so slick. So when you have that frame and that story that you've told, you can play with the boundaries of that frame a little bit, can't you?
And I think this, it works in the context as well because it's, Japan is obviously, and certainly at the time, was so strict on the rules. So for it to, you know, be like a quirk of the rules that ended up being the thing that cost Fujinami the WCW title is quite an interesting idea. And yeah, it's just a shame that they never really, on the back of this, exploited it as well as they could have done. Because Fujinami and Flair over in America could have been a lot bigger than it was if WCW had promoted it better. Because here it felt massive, like it was a dream match because it was, you know, your top guy from New Japan, your top guy from WCW, which, you know, didn't really happen at the time. I'm trying to think of, I don't know what the equivalent would be nowadays.
Well, I mean, it would be Okada defending against
John Cena or something, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
Because it is ace against ace, isn't it, really? You know, this is where Flair is associated with the NWA and WCW. It's not just that he was the champion. He was the guy. He was the guy that carried the belt for so long. And Fujinami was the ace of New Japan Pro Wrestling. He was so associated with that product and that brand.
So, yeah. So if they want to do Okada versus John Cena to play off this, then that's fine by us.
But you have to do it right.
Yeah, and do it in Japan.
Yeah. But yeah, and then we kind of just have to have a quick chat as well as the business of this particular card. 64,500 is a lot of people to watch a wrestling match, you know. And
it is. It's quite a few, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, New Japan were renowned for papering shows, and it's only recently that they've actually said, actually, we're not going to paper shows anymore. We're going to give you the actual figures of people who actually turned up. And so I think the actual paying customer number would have been around 55,000. But still, 55,000 customers to watch a wrestling match is really, really good. And it shows you the kind of level that New Japan were at. You know, I was looking around today at other cards to try and see what we can do in future episodes, and there wasn't an awful lot going on in Japan at this time because it was a year of flux. You look at Joshi and the Crush Girls have just retired, so they're establishing new people, and they didn't hold any major supercards that year except WrestleMarimpiad. You look at All Japan, they're going through a time of flux as well because Tenryu leaves to go form Super World Sports. Super World Sports is something we will talk about in a future episode because they had a big card also at the Tokyo Dome at the end of the year. But, you know, this is a transitional year, and New Japan kind of had the playing field to themselves as far as media coverage was concerned.
Yeah, and that's fully where I would see it in the context of the time of, like you say, this was where New Japan were about to enter this era of, like you say, creating the new stars and building the younger guys. I'm just trying to think back to, like, sort of how the G1 stuff played out. Was it 91?
It was 93 was the first G1, which was a title for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship, which came from, like we said earlier, the politics of this particular card. Yeah.
So there you go. So it all kind of plays into that. And then, like we say, the rise of people like Chono and Hashimoto and Muto not under the face paint and things like that. So, yeah, it's an interesting precursor to where New Japan then became.
It is also
kind of this juggernaut, yeah.
Yeah, it's also slightly amazing that Shinya Hashimoto was not on the show.
It really is, yeah. And it's not something I'd really thought about until, like, after I'd watched it. Like, why? Where was he? <You know? laughs> Like, because Hashimoto is the longest reigning New Japan IWGP champion ever, am I correct?
Yes, he has more title defenses than anyone else, if I remember correctly, yes.
I think he's the longest reign at 400 and something days. That's something we can talk about in another podcast, because I've been a big geek with that stuff, trying to work it out of when Okada will potentially break this record and stuff like that, so...
Yeah, we will be back with WCW NWA Supercards, WCW New Japan Supercards when we look at World Wrestling Peace Festival in 1994.
And they did a few more super shows as well, so that it was obviously enough of a success. And like you say, with the amount that they drew to the Tokyo Dome, it's not a surprise that they wanted to do it again. How successful was it from the other side, I suppose, is the question for WCW. Because like we've said, they didn't necessarily reference all of it on television afterwards. It was quite a strange situation in some ways.
Because you don't really get... Obviously, they'd had Muta prior to this as the Great Muta in a strong run. That was probably the best thing that came out of that talent swap agreement at the time. You know, later on in the year, like I said, Iizuka and Fujinami will come and challenge obviously Fujinami comes and defends the NWA world title, or, you know, challenges for the WCW world title, depending on which way you look at it, at Super Brawl, which wasn't a great main event. The actual match was good, but it didn't get the reaction that they wanted and didn't draw necessarily as well as they wanted to. Then Iizuka and Fujinami come and get beat up by the Steiner brothers later in the year, which is, you know, not good.
not fun
for anyone, nor was it big nor clever. And so there wasn't an awful lot till the next Super Show the following year. Certainly New Japan were getting a lot more out of it than WCW were.
I think it kind of led to the Liger stuff, which was another...
Yeah,
coming over to America, but that was a little bit later on.
Yeah, and the funny thing was, even then, Pillman didn't like Wrestling Liger.
That's so funny.
Yeah, yeah. Pillman was a character guy. He always thought his character was the most important, didn't really like doing pure wrestling matches, which for a guy who grew up in the Calgary territory in Stampede is a bit insane.
And particularly how good a wrestler he actually was. Like you say, particularly at that time as Flying Brian, he was another guy who really pioneered that style. I mean, obviously the fact that he did believe more in character is very telling with what he'd gone to create with the loose cannon stuff. But it's a funny quirk, that one.
It certainly is. Right then, well, that kind of closes our coverage on Starrcade in the Tokyo Dome, or WCW New Japan Super Show, or whatever you want to call it. Something that happened in March in 1991. And lots of people went, and it was fun.
Big deal.
Yes. So thank you very much for listening today. Please do listen to the other podcasts on the WrestleTalk TV network. Ben and Gavin on the squash, doing great things. It's a wonderful, entertaining listen. You should go listen to them. You go check out the WrestleTalk YouTube channel as well. Ollie Davis has some cool stuff for you to look at. I'd like to thank my guest for today, Mr. Alex Watt. That's AlexWatt187 on Twitter. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
No, thank you very much for having me, as always. Hopefully I didn't ramble too much at this early hour as I'm still waking up.
Next week we should be back with some New Japan reviews of the shows that have gone on recently, because there's been some interesting title matches. So we'll talk to you then. Take care, have a good week, and see you soon. Bye.